Welcome to Education Currents, a show designed to provide current educational news and commentary from a Christian worldview. The greatest resource any community has is its children, and by providing for them the best possible education, we are providing for ourselves and future generations. Join us as we explore the latest social and political issues surrounding education. Here are your hosts, Paul Tooley and Dr. Rose Gamblin.
Welcome, welcome to Education Currents. I'm Dr. Rose Gamblin, and with me today is Dr. Richard Tooley, and we're going to talk about knowledge and learning and what makes learning meaningful. What would be a good guiding question for our show today, Richard Tooley?
Well, I think one of the things we could start off with is, you know, we send kids to school, and we graduate them, and we look at the test scores of our kids, and we find that the United States ranks lower than we all think it should in the world test scores market. So what's happening to our society? What's happening to our kids? Why aren't they learning?
Yeah, so if we're going to look at meaningful learning, then knowledge becomes a tool. Now, explain how knowledge is a tool.
Well, think about it. A lot of the research that goes on around this has to do with how do you use what you learn. And so you take children and you put them through school and teach them Latin, as an example, when they get into high school. Well, what do they do with it? We teach them algebra. What do they do with that? Brown, Collins, and Duguid did some research on this and defined knowledge as being a tool. And if the knowledge is practical and usable, then you have a useful tool. For instance, teaching someone how to speak Spanish and then sending them off to Spain would be like giving them knowledge that becomes a useful tool, because in Spain they would have to speak Spanish. So now it becomes practical. Another example of a useful tool, or a tool that became unuseful, was given with a group of people who were at Weight Watchers. And one of the problems that they were given was how to take 2/3 of 3/4 of a cup of something. Well, they sat around thinking about that, and finally they just took 3/4 of a cup and dumped it out on a board, smoothed it out, and then drew 3 lines into it so that they now had 3 equal sections. They took 2 of those sections and put it in a cup, and they now had 2/3 of 3/4 of a cup. And one of the men who was in the process of doing this says, you know, and to think of it, I was a math major in college, and they couldn't figure it out mathematically, so they had to do it practically. So the question is, why wasn't that math major able to use the algebraic formula that would come up with the answer for that? So there is an example of knowledge that was not made into a useful tool for them.
Yes. Well, I had the same dilemma not too long ago. I was trying to fill some tires with cement to make some tetherball hole stands that I could move for the students. So I thought it'd be great to have them practically find out the cubic feet of cement. So they measured it with inches, and they found out the cubic inches. But then I couldn't for the life of me remember how to convert the cubic inches into cubic feet. Well, praise the Lord for the computer. We just went there and there was a conversion where we could put in our inches and it converted it to feet. But they were just, you know, they were stuck as I was stuck. We'd started out in a very practical way, but then we couldn't remember how to convert. In our algebra books didn't tell us how to convert the cubic inches into cubic feet.
Yes, much of knowledge and its utility has to do with community. A lot of people don't make that connection there, but I can remember going to work for a factory in a maintenance department, and while I was working there, we had a young man come in who was newly hired, and the foreman said to him first thing, "Hey, George, I want you to go get me a left-handed spanner." And off the young man went looking for a left-handed spanner. hour later, he comes back and says, I can't find any. Well, everybody had a great laugh over that because there is no such thing as a left-handed spanner. So there was an example of a culture that mm-hmm. was telling them to go and do something. Well, he didn't have appropriate knowledge for that culture to be able to make it work for him. So when we think about the acquisition of knowledge, we have to also begin to think about the culture. And, Brown, Collin, and Duguid also came up with the idea of enculturation. You know, when you take a student as a first grader and you bring them into a school, school has a process of enculturation that goes on in it. You bring them in there and then they have to learn how to become part of that school's culture. Well, knowledge also requires a process of enculturation for that knowledge to become useful to the person. So the person is, as they become part of the community, become part of the culture of the community, knowledge takes on different meanings. An example of that would be the word chisel. You know, here chisel is a tool, but chisel has a different meaning depending upon whether you're a carpenter, a mechanic, or say a stonemason. So it would have a different function, and it is understood within the culture that it's in. So knowledge has to be also understood within the culture that a person finds themselves in.
So community and creating a cultural desire for students to want to learn, not only is that the responsibility of teachers, but also of parents. In other words, is your family, do you have the cultural essence of loving books, that learning is fun?
Well, there's something interesting when you think about the culture and learning. I don't know how many people there are out there who really get a kick out of learning for learning's sake. I don't think there are really anybody who gets a real kick out of learning for learning's
sake. I think there are some kids that you tell them what to do, and it's actually in Kolb's learning cycle. It's the I forget the exact name of it, but it's one section of the learning cycle that matches up to that student that loves to learn just for learning's sake. They don't care what it is. If you tell them they need to do something, they just can hardly wait to do it.
Yeah, that would be the apprehension.
Okay.
So they're apprehending knowledge. And that part's okay, but then that same student, they would probably be, you know, as Malcolm Gladwell would point out in his book Tipping Point, they probably would be talking about someone who was a maven. You know, they collected knowledge. They simply collected all of this knowledge. But I question whether that's, you know, simply the acquisition of knowledge is really learning. Because Kolb identifies apprehension, then transformation, then comprehension, and then transformation. So his cycle is, if you look at it, there's an apprehension where you're apprehending knowledge, you're gaining knowledge. Then it has to go through a transformative process where you actually do something practical with what you've brought into your head or into your brain to make it transformative. And once you have experimented with it, now you begin to comprehend what that knowledge really means. So you go through a comprehension phase, and then you go through another transformative phase where you take that knowledge as you've comprehended it and reapply it to practical solutions or practical everyday living. And now you've gone full circle, and now you can acquire more knowledge based on what you have. So learning generally is development of mental models, if you really wanted to go there.
Now, I tried to bring that idea down into some very simple questions of why, how, what if. So the why was where I was apprehending the knowledge. The what was what I was apprehending. The how was how I was going to take that knowledge and apply it, either to hook it to things I already knew or hook it to things that I wanted to know something more about. And then the what if was it just smoothly transitioned into the what if. What if then I took this knowledge and I did this with it? Now, on a very simple level, in a preschool classroom, you can see the children doing this. You can see them taking these questions. I mean, they don't know the questions, but we know the questions. And you can see them trying to, you know, maybe take the blocks over into the clay area. And well, what if we, you know, use the blocks with the clay and that kind of thing. So you see kind of that on a very simplistic level, you kind of see that cycle of learning happening, and it just should be a beautiful cycle as a child grows.
I think that this is where a lot of research has yet to be done, is in the area of how community fits into, or how education fits into community. Community into education, education into community. For instance, you start with preschool kids, and you're teaching them the fundamentals of learning. I mean, it's basic building blocks on which they are going to apprehend or gain knowledge. You have a pretty good situation there for them. I mean, it's pretty simple. It's not getting into anything. But how do you move then from there to helping teenagers cope? And I will surmise this based on the research I've done, and I think that it's limited. I think there's a lot more research that needs to be done in this, particularly in the relationship between community and learning, particularly as it applies to life skills, that as the student in the schools gets into higher grades, the disconnect between the school and its community that it serves has the tendency to become wider. There's a gap that's created.
Well, you are saying it in such politically correct terms. It is huge. There is a big chasm. I've often said every teacher should go down and teach at the preschool level, because they would see there a beautiful cycle of learning. They would see there the culture of learning. And the kids love it. They can hardly wait to come to school. They don't want to leave school. Kindergarten, they can hardly wait to come to school. They don't want to leave it. And then the chasm starts. And I'm happy to know of any ideas that you have to prevent that chasm.
Well, and that's a difficult question, but I think if you took a look at...
Well, even the word community conjures up the idea of a connection.
Yes, it does. And that's the interesting thing. There's a lot of areas in community that we can go into, because community is changing dramatically. I would say 50 years ago, pretty much everybody knew who their next-door neighbor was, even if their next-door neighbor was half mile away.
Yes.
Today, I venture to guess that most people do not know who their neighbor is, even two houses down from them, let alone one house down from them. If they do, it's on a very cursory level. They're not watching out for each other. There's a lot more fear. And community has shifted from something which is geographically located to something that is much more psychologically located.
Yes. Well, we have to take a break right now, but when we come back, we're going to start with community. Community and learning. We'll be right back.
Mama! Mama! Where are you? Mama!
There are over 145 million orphans in the world today, and how can we help? Well, first of all, you can pray. Take courage from the life of George Mueller, who raised $225 million in answer to prayer alone and saved thousands of orphans from lives of appalling destitution. I'm Dr. Rose Gamblin, and I've chosen Restore a Child as the humanitarian organization I'm going to support.
To make a donation, go to www.restoreachild.org or call 877-745-7833. That's 877-745-7833.
Welcome back to Education Currents. I'm talking with Dr. Richard Tooley about learning, making learning meaningful, knowledge as a tool. And where we left off was we were talking about community. And community, you had mentioned something as a psychological community or the psychology of community. Explain what you meant by that.
Well, within community, you have first and foremost the idea of belonging, this connectedness. In community, there's a reciprocal relationship. You give to the community and you get from the community. People like to belong to it because it empowers them. It gives them a sense of belonging. And then by the same token, they feel they can contribute to community. They're giving to something that's of a much larger picture than they are. Well, in your local community, that used to be the case. You know, everybody got together and they had different events that everybody was involved with. Now, community is shifting. People can be in multiple communities. You can be in a community at work, and that's probably still the largest community that people find themselves in, or the one that takes the most of their time. Because most people go to work, they're at work for 8 hours a day or 40 hours a week. So they're 40 hours a week in their work community. But another community that's really growing is the Facebook community, example, online communities.
Mm-hmm.
When you start taking that whole concept of community and you say, okay, we have a school community that we send our kids to. If the school community is strong, but the community that should surround that school and create the support for that school is disconnected from that school, then the school is basically an island. So kids will go into the school, but they will not be understanding what is going on in the community as a whole. And that creates a problem. When you have that disconnect, then the knowledge that is gained in that school does not necessarily have any meaning.
Now, whose responsibility is it? Is it the parents to make sure the community surrounding the school is connected to the school, or is it the school's responsibility to make sure that they connect and reach out to the surrounding community?
Well, I think it has to be both ways. However, I think this would be a good study to do too. One of the differences, say, between public school and private school, I would surmise, would be that in private school, there would be considerably more community involvement. The community that school was situated in, whether physically or otherwise, would be much stronger. There would be more participation. There would be much more web-like configuration, both among parents, with other parents, with school, with parents and school, and with kids and parents, so that you end up looking at a much more three-dimensional web of community. You know, you would have generational community going on, and you would have inter-parental community going on, parents that are communicating with each other and have each other as friends. And then you would have school teachers who would know their parents by names and would also have parents who were vesting their time in the school and being part of it. A smaller group of people would help create that. You know, you think about some of the work of Malcolm Gladwell when he was looking at sizes of community where everybody knew everybody else's name. It was like 150 people. Once you get over 150 people, you don't know everybody else by their first name. So then you have sub-communities that begin to form. But I think, too, that now when you take a look at what goes on in a public school system, where you have the federal government starting to inject itself more and more into the public school system, I know that there are going to be people who are proponents of that. But once you start having that, and then you try to create a standard that all public schools must meet, you really are running roughshod over community in a lot of ways when you do that. Because communities are not going to necessarily be defined by the federal government.
So you think the core curriculum standards actually war against creating good communities?
No. I think what happens with... I think that the problem that one has with core curriculum standards is that they don't take into account the meaning of the knowledge of those core curriculum.
So we've almost gone full circle ourselves.
Yeah. We would be moving back. So you can see, if you look at it, you can see that you could put out a set of core curriculum, but those core curriculums are going to have different meanings in different communities. And still at this point, geographically different communities are going to have different meaning out of those different core. And those core curriculum are going to have different priorities based on the community's needs.
So as we have about 2 minutes left of the show, so what impact does the redefining of the community play out in the acquisition of meaningful knowledge? That sounds like a very academic question.
Yeah, and when you think about that, as you look at society over the past, say, 30 or 40 years, especially in the United States, as families begin to become much more granular, actually to the point of becoming more powdery, as they used to be defined, where you had the father and the mother and the children and the grandparents, you had multi-generations in a family, and family ties were strong, and family was defined a certain way. The culture was defined a certain way. There was a lot of strength in that. Knowledge then would have had a meaning based in that. But now, as society becomes much more nebulous, the definition of what makes up a family becomes more nebulous, all of these different things become more nebulous, then the meaning of knowledge, by virtue of that lack of anchor points, would become much more nebulous. And now, if we're going to continue along the process of redefining what community is, we will then have to go also with the process of redefining what meaning is to the knowledge that we are teaching. And so, in the meantime, then, what really will we be giving our children of value in the school system? Will the school become the cultural island in and of itself, and this chasm between the community that should be supporting the school and the school community inside itself widen and deepen to the point where children have no motivation to continue to not only apprehend and comprehend knowledge, but to make it transformative to them?
Mm-hmm.
Will the practical disconnect grow to the point that schooling has no value?
Mm.
And I think we're hearing some of that, actually.
Yes. Well, on that note, we're coming to the conclusion of our show. I certainly appreciate the discussion, the meaning of knowledge. What does it mean to our society, to our kids? What are they learning in school that will be inspirational and transformational for them? I think that's what we all want, but to get there, many questions need to be asked and answered. Thank you so much, Dr. Tooley, for being with us. And I have one last thing to say, and that is keep learning.